This is Peter Fisher, and this is episode 9 of the Fisher Files podcast. And this week, I want to talk about feeding the good wolf. Last week, I promised you that this week I'd be talking about aggregators and NetNewsWire and RSS feeds and things like that to keep up. But sort of a thought intervened, and I decided that this would be a good week to talk about feeding the good wolf. So what does this title mean? The title comes from a sermon that Reverend Anita Farber Robinson gave a few weeks ago at the Unitarian Church in Cambridge on Harvard Square. And I don't really remember the larger point of the sermon, but somewhere in the sermon there was a story about a little Indian boy and his father, and the little Indian boy was having some kind of internal conflict, yada, yada, yada. And the father said that inside each one of us, there are two wolves, a good wolf and a bad wolf. And the implications of the wolf are obvious. And these wolves are always fighting with each other. And, you know, yada, yada, yada. And the little Indian boy asks his father, well, which wolf wins? And the father said, the one you feed. That really had a very profound impact on me because, sort of in reflecting a little bit about this story, I realized that there was about a 5-year period of time where I fed the bad wolf. And even though it's much, much better now, there are still times when I'm feeding the bad wolf. Feeding the bad wolf is basically brooding or churning or stewing about something, usually a person that you have some kind of unresolved business with, and you think about it, you think about what you should have said, you think about what they should think, you think about what they said, you may think of various ways of harming them or plotting against them, but basically it's not a very good way to think. And thinking about the things that in this podcast I'm really trying to do is one of the main things is to try to really still the internal dialogue so that more spiritual things can take place. And there are three things that kind of make a mess in our minds all the time. One of them is just all the things we have to do. And that's really what we've talked about mostly so far in the podcast, how to get those things out and capture them. The other are daydreams, and I've said a little bit about how to maybe get rid of the daydreams that don't do so much for us. And today I want to really try to focus in on how to get rid of feeding the bad wolf. Because my experience has been, once you stop feeding the bad wolf, it just kind of goes away and the good wolf comes out. So what's kind of a typical example of what I'm talking about? Suppose it's Friday and you have your weekly group meeting, and suppose it's your turn to make a presentation, and you go ahead and you're making your presentation, and maybe one of the more obnoxious members of your group begins making a lot of critical remarks and perhaps even really attacking you. And maybe you respond, and it's not really an argument, but damage is done. And you come out of that, and you're angry with the person, and you have to go home to your family, and perhaps you spend really the weekend thinking almost constantly about what you should have said, why it's so unfair, who you're going to talk to. And there's really nothing you can do about it because it's the weekend. It can wreck a weekend. And if you have a very troublesome person in your life, as I did, you can get into that state more or less constantly. It's very isolating because you're so totally fixated on these things that you're not really listening to your family, you're not participating, you're feeding the bad wolf. Like with many spiritual things, there's a great idea, but very little practical information on how to achieve it. And I can't say I have great insights. Frequently, though, one of the best things you can do when you're in this kind of conflict with someone is to really simply go and talk to them. And when you do, you should go in a very non-confrontational way. And really mainly listen. Sit down, make a time with them when you have enough time to really do this. Sit down and kind of just ask them what they think and try to get into a discussion with them. I would say 95% of the time that I've had, you know, a really serious conflict, something that's, you know, wrecked a night, by the time I got with the person and sat down and talked with them, the whole thing just went away. Very frequently, it wasn't even a misunderstanding. It was just a difference of opinion, and that's fine. You're going to have differences of opinion, and you can work to resolve them, but you can't let it get under your skin and eat at you. Now, the scenario I've just painted, it's really not possible to do that because it's a weekend and you might have other plans. I would say that's a very good time to say to a spouse or loved one, look, I really just need to resolve this, and try to get in touch with the person as soon as you can. Not let it fester, because the longer it festers, the more you dig in, the more you become fixed in your point of view, and the harder it comes out. So that might just be really a good time to make this top priority, put other things on hold and resolve it. I find when talking to a person about this, or when trying to resolve something like this, the most important way to do it is face to face. If that's really not possible, phone is a good or okay second option. What is absolutely not okay is email. This is one of the worst things to try to do via email. This is something that's very sensitive. You need to be able to hear voice tones. You need to be able to see facial gestures or facial tics and gestures. And all of that's just missing in email. And trying to resolve it by email can very frequently only make it worse. Now, there are going to be some times when you only have email available, and then you have to proceed with great caution and in really kind of a very formal, gentle way. Things go nonlinear in email very, very quickly. So what happens if you can't talk it out with someone? And in the five-year circumstance I'm talking about, I did try to talk it out with the person many times, and we were just at odds. I think in that case, you really have a couple of options. Option number one is to just make a boundary. We haven't talked about boundaries in this podcast yet, and it's coming. But you need boundaries in your life. You need real separations between different things. And this will be one of them. And what you have to be able to do is sit down with that person and say, look, we're not agreeing, we're not getting along, this is bad for both of us, so we're just going to make a boundary, and you stay on your side, and I'll stay on mine. It could be, you know, dividing up a research grant, cutting it in some fraction that you each get. It could be a physical boundary in an office. It could be an agreement not to be certain places at certain times. This is pretty extreme, and it may or may not work, but it's sometimes necessary just to make a boundary. It's the only possibility. The third thing is to simply get rid of that person in your life. I mean, just either change jobs or move or something, but there are some people who you simply can't be around, and there's no shame in that. And if you recognize it and do it with, the proper formality and gentleness, it can be a positive thing for both. That's what I ended up doing, and I think both me and the other person have been much better off since. I can't say I ever came around to his point of view, but at least we're not losing sleep over this. So one other thing is you have to recognize that there are going to be people in your life that you simply can't get along with, and that's not a statement against you as a person. Now, if at some point you find that there are a large number of such people, you might want to reflect on your outlook and perhaps seek some professional guidance because, in the course of a lifetime, having a few people that you just can't stand, well, that's understandable. And suddenly it's like a lot of the people you know, maybe there's something more to this than just the problems of normal human intercourse. Now, those are the options. The question is, how do you get through it? The best way to think about going about this, if it's a long-term project or problem, is to make it into a project, just the way you would create a research project when you get a good idea. And that means, getting a file, sitting down, writing what you know, making a to-do list, putting to-dos on your various to-do lists and working through them. It might be that you really have to study the situation and understand it at some length and really approach it the way you would a major research project. That's perfectly okay. I think you will find that once you have a systematized treatment, well, let me back up. Assuming that this isn't something that's just resolved in one conversation, if it's a really deep conflict and maybe it involves multiple people, I think what you'll find is that the minute you turn it into a project and start making to-do lists and executing things and moving ahead, the bad wolf will quiet down pretty quickly. What the bad wolf is telling you is not just that there's just a conflict with another person, but it's really a conflict inside you. If the person were just a total jerk, it wouldn't bother you so much. But usually there is a conflict that you have some feelings that are positive for the person and also some very negative, and they're fighting with each other. And the second you can get that out of your mind and into some system so that you can break it down into little chunks and work through it, the quicker your mind will kind of quiet down and you won't have to worry about this particular thing. So I mentioned in the beginning that there were really these sort of three areas of dialogue that take place in your mind, the to-dos, the daydreams, and the feeding the bad wolf. I just wanted to mention daydreams a little bit. We all walk around with sort of these pleasant daydreams of things we'd like to be doing, and very frequently there are things that we'd like to be able to do or be doing that would impress other people. And those things are fine, They pass the time. They give you a little uplift when things aren't going well. But even daydreams can get out of hand, and one can dwell on them sort of obsessively, to the point where they become annoying and distracting. A good way to get rid of a daydream is to just write it all down. I did this once. I think I mentioned it in an earlier podcast. I was just getting so, feeling so dumb thinking about this silly, elaborate daydream I had that at one point I just sat down with my Trio and two-thumbed the whole thing in. It's about 6 pages. And, that really got rid of it. I just don't really have that daydream anymore. Now, I'm not saying that you should just go and just stomp on every little daydream that you have. That would be silly. Daydreams are very valuable. They're frequently ways of that you use to work things out. But, the ones that you just have over and over and over, and you just know they're not really very good for you. That's a good way of getting rid of them. So coming back to feeding the bad wolf, another aspect to this is not only is it unpleasant to be brooding about something, it's also bad for you. I believe the way the mind works is that the more you think about something in a certain way, the more fixed it becomes. And consequently, the more you brood on a situation, the more you cast that situation in stone in your mind. So it's really very important that when you begin to brood on something, you take some kind of positive action that is going to lead to a resolution. Now, that could be talking to the person, and that could be starting a project. But what I'm trying to emphasize, or cutting them out of your life, but what I'm trying to emphasize is that when you find yourself in that state, it's a very good time to tell your family or loved ones or, whoever you need to that you've got a problem and taking care of it is going to be top priority for the time being. And once it's taken care of, then you can spend more time on other things. But I really want to emphasize you can't let things fester. Now, as usual, we spend a lot of time talking about the bad things. There is also the good wolf. And, good wolves are ideas you have and relationships you'd like to form and happiness over new people you meet. And in a similar way, you brood about them, but it's very positive. It's transitive thinking. It's thinking about the future and what's going to happen and what you want and how it connects with bigger things in your life. Whereas the bad wolf is, much more about what happened and what you should have done. The good wolf too is a place where projects are going to spin out of. And what you want to do is work at capturing them and in the ways we've talked about. And sort of the more you're able to do that, the more you're able to sort of take the things that the good wolf is giving you, the more you feed it, the more it will give you. So it's really, you handle the two things in just the same way, but one is just much more productive, and so you're writing things down and capturing things that, from the good wolf feeding, in much the same way, but you're not working to get rid of it. So you're not thinking in terms of making it stop. Well, that's kind of all I had to say about those things. The main thing I'd like to emphasize is that when you're find yourself in one of these brooding situations, take action as quickly as you can, and get it resolved, because it's a bad thing to be stuck in.
Daydream takes me to a place and time when I was younger and you were mine.
So for this week's Mind Feed, I actually have a very interesting paper from Physical Review Letters, the title of which is Non-Invariance of Space-Time Scale Ranges Under a Lorentz Transformation and the Implications for the Study of Relativistic Interactions. And this is in PRL 98-130405. And this is actually not a particularly sophisticated calculation, but I was kind of struck by how new it is that nobody's done it before on such a an old topic. What the author shows is that if you consider two interacting systems, and he uses, for example, laser plasma acceleration, or where you have a laser pulse going through a plasma, or a high energy particle beam interacting with an electron cloud, or a free electron laser, basically where you have a pulse of something that's relatively small going through another structure that's relatively large. You can define ratios in the space and time between the, for example, largest spatial dimension that matters and the smallest spatial dimension that matters, and similarly for time. And if you're going to simulate these systems by computer or carry out a numerical calculation, what you want is are those ratios to be relatively small, because you impose a grid both in time and space, and you have to carry out the calculations in the grid. And what the author shows, and it's not trivial, but it's relatively simple, is that you can minimize those two parameters by an appropriately chosen Lorentz transformation. And, for example, one of the first things he shows, which is just kind of obvious, if you're thinking of how, for example, two beams interact, or how a beam going through some kind of accelerator interacts, the best place to study it is in a frame moving along with the beam. Similarly, for a Wakefield accelerator, where a electron pulse moves through a plasma, the best place to study the dynamics, meaning the place with the smallest range in space and time, is in the moving frame along with the beam. For the final example, he actually shows something very valuable, where he thinks of a relativistic beam of 10 to the 12 protons moving at a velocity of gamma equals 500 through a beam line that's a few kilometers long with a magnetic field. And by choosing the appropriate Lorentz transformation, which isn't obvious, he's able to reduce the number of steps required to carry out the calculation of the orbit dynamics of the particle from something like 5 million to something like 5,000. And this is just kind of an interesting little problem that's been worked out. So I recommend looking at that paper. There was an interesting paper in Science Today. It's actually the cover article. And it's a mathematical analysis of a Renaissance paper painting, Piero della Fresca's Flagellation. And it's one of those things where somebody has looked with from a mathematical standpoint, and it's a kind of controversial. They've looked from a mathematical standpoint at this painting and tried to intuit some additional meaning and identify some characters in the painting. It's interesting both in and of itself, and because there's kind of a little academic snit going on about whether or not this is all right. There is another Nature article. Nature is doing pretty well recently, which I found very interesting about. The title is Seasonal Dynamics of Recurrent Epidemics. And what the authors show is that in periodic epidemics like mumps, where there is seasonal forcing. So for example, in mumps, all the kids come back to school in the fall, and there's kind of some time when they all give each other the mumps, and then there's a spike in the number of kids that have mumps, and pretty soon everybody who's susceptible has it, and then it dies away because there's no one else to infect, and people get better. They show a lot of things through numerical modeling. Again, this is something that you thought they'd have done a long time ago. And what they show is that there's a kind of a threshold number of people needed to get the epidemic started. And that threshold is actually dependent on the time of year during which the epidemic starts. It's based on what's called the classic SIR model, and I'm just looking what SIR means, susceptible, infectious, or recovered epidemic model, which is just a set of coupled differential equations, which are then solved numerically. And again, it's really just kind of interesting to me that people are still learning things in this way about epidemiology using, you know, pretty simple models. Could be some place where, you know, a smart physicist has an in.
Used to be love, that was you and me. Daydream took my heart around the bend. Surely this romance had to end. Once I was kissing, now I'm just missing. Now I'm just missing you.
Well, that's it for this week. Next week, I'm going to go back as planned and talk about things you should be looking at if you're going to be a practicing scientist and generally well-informed person. And for the first time, I'll talk a little bit about how technology can help you and what you should be looking at to keep yourself informed. I'd love to hear from you about this, what you think the well-rounded, intelligent person needs to be looking at. So you can email me, fisherp@mit.edu, or you can post a comment on the website. I'd also like to thank Diana Henderson and a MIT alum for helping us get a alumni funds award to help support this podcast. And one of the things I'm thinking of doing, we requested, Sheila Holzer Marston and I requested some funds to set up a little kind of studio for podcasting. And one of the things I'm thinking of doing is just inviting people to come in and do a podcast and maybe subsidizing a dinner for anyone who wants to do a podcast on what they do and who they are. And we could post these on the site. So let me know what you'd think of doing that. And I'd like to thank Diana Henderson and the MIT alum for this. I really appreciate it. And as usual, I'd like to thank John Marston and Sean Thompson and Maynard Galinas from the LNS Computational Facility, and Bonnie Newman and Homer Reed from REFS for their continuing support. And so until next week, enjoy your work and life in Cambridge or wherever you are.
Upon my mind, once I was kissing, now I'm just missing, now I'm just missing.